Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this podcast topic is Operational Framework. We welcome Colonel Richard Akena, Commander of the Mission Command Training Program, MCTP, and Colonel Retired Rich Creed, Director here at CAD. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lisa. Good to be here.
I very much appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
A few months ago, I came across the Center for Army Lessons Learned, or CALL, handbook. It's called the Fiscal Year 23 Mission Command Training in Large-Scale Combat Operations, Key Observations. With the first key observation having a seamless tie to doctrine, because it was an observation on the Army's operational framework. Today, I'd like to dive into this topic with the what, the why, and the lessons learned. So, Mr. Creed, could you tee up the conversation with a quick snapshot of an operational framework?
Yeah, sure thing, Lisa. First, I'll start with anytime something's labeled seamless, we know we're going to have a challenge because nothing's seamless in our business. So before you start talking about operational framework, you got to understand this idea of operational approach. So that's the way in which a commander visualizes how we're going to conduct an operation or a series of operations. So that operational logic, it gives you a logic for how you're going to sequence the employment of friendly capabilities against an enemy to achieve your desired end state. You got to sequence those things in time and space. That operational approach also gives you a unifying purpose and a focus to the operations. You know, you're meeting some higher intent. And so any sound operational approach is going to balance risk and uncertainty with friction and chance. So that operational approach provides a basis for detailed planning, and it allows leaders to establish a logical operational framework. Taken together, that operational approach plus an operational framework helps you produce a decent operations order for your subordinate formations. So what's an operational framework? Well, the purpose of it's to organize an area of geographic and operational responsibility for the commander and then provide a way to describe the employment of those forces. It also allows you to describe how you would echelon those forces. The definition of an operational framework, it's a cognitive tool used to assist commanders and staffs in clearly visualizing and describing the application of combat power in time, space, purpose, and resources in the concept of operations. Now, one of the things that we've done differently in the 2022 FM30 that we hadn't done in the past is we talked about the types of operations you want to conduct first as a way to introduce the areas in the framework, the geographical areas, as opposed to talking about the areas first. So if you figure out deep operations, close operations, rear operations, for example, then you look at the terrain in your assigned area and you start to think through how you would echelon your forces and capabilities in time and space. So it's a small change, but I think it's important because I think when we were focused on the operations we were conducting in Afghanistan, Iraq, we had the same areas, assigned areas, year after year after year. So you would focus on the area and not the operations, whereas in a conventional war-fighting scenario, that area is continuously changing, particularly on the offense. So you need to think in terms of time and space differently than when you have a fixed area of operations. I don't know, Ike, what do you think?
No, I think that absolutely is valid. As I listened to you talk through the operational approach and the operational framework, it really reminds me of how the commander is driving the operations process. And really, in order to understand and visualize, direct and describe, lead and assess through that operations process that we see so often in our warfighter exercises. And so that the operational framework that we're talking about today definitely is one of those tools in order for the commander to visualize and understand the operations process.
I want to kind of talk history. Okay. I think average doctrine readers probably have noticed changes or tweaks to the operational framework over time. And I tried to dive into like long-term history of operational framework and realize that's another episode. However, I'd like to focus on just recent changes to the operational framework. Mr. Creed, what were the changes to the operational framework between the 2017 version of FM3O and the 2022 version of FM3O? And why were these changes made to the operational framework?
Yeah, Lisa. So we'll start with what changed. A lot of things did stay very close to the same, but we recognized, to right off the bat, I'll talk some whys. There were some elements of the operational framework in 2017 that never really caught on with the force. So we had, in terms of the areas, close areas, deep areas, support areas, and consolidation areas. And there's a long story behind how we ended up with consolidation areas. We, at the time, wanted to use rear areas, go deep, close, rear, support. But there was concerns that people, there were two concerns. One, that there was a negative aspect to a rear area. And then there was this idea that we wanted to emphasize the importance of consolidating gains. Well, where does that primarily take place? Well, then we would say that was a consolidation area. So that didn't really work out. So we went to close, deep, support, and rear areas. So it's deep, close, rear, support. That's what the current doctrine says. And I don't expect that to change again anytime soon. The other thing that changed is we went from decisive shaping and sustaining operations with main and supporting efforts and reserves to just main efforts, supporting efforts, and reserves. And we did away with decisive shaping and sustaining operations. Why did we do that? Well, we did that at the suggestion of the Combined Arms Center commander, Lieutenant General Rainey at the time, who said, you know, I'm not so sure how applicable decisive shaping and sustaining operations would be to conventional conflict. And so we did it as a thought experiment. And when we sent the first draft out, we pulled decisive shaping and sustaining out. And of the 2,000 odd comments we got, there were only 5 comments from the entire Army that even noticed that we had pulled it out. So I'm not sure what that indicates, probably a few different things. And the second time we did it, got about the same number of comments, and this time we got maybe 11 or 12 comments from the field. So the experiment was a success in terms of it didn't cause riots in the streets for all those people that follow doctrine closely. But what it did do as we went and talked to audiences and engaged with them about the reasons why, and a lot of what we came to understand in terms of the benefit actually came from MCTP, which was MCTP is the only forum where divisions and corps are getting continuously undergoing training, and people get to put the doctrine to the test in simulation. So one of the unintended benefits that we hadn't really thought of at the time was when you did away with this idea of decisive and shaping operations, you actually freed people up psychologically in many ways. So if the division or corps is planning their decisive operation and it's not going good, right? Things are going badly. The enemy is defeating you during whatever your decisive operation was. It's very hard to come up with a new decisive operation on the fly. I mean, you put everything into this is the decisive operation. So unless you were completely wrong, well, what's your next decisive operation, right? So by doing away with that and going to main effort and then supporting efforts and reserve, it's much easier intellectually to go, okay, my main effort's not succeeding. I'm shifting my main effort to this. I'm not shifting a decisive operation. I'm just shifting the main effort. So my priorities of resources, my priorities of fires, my priorities of movement, my priorities of support, all of those kinds of things, you can shift that in a rather agile fashion. The other thing we found was on the sustaining operations piece, when we separated out sustaining as its own part of the operational framework, a lot of people got really comfortable with making sustainment the purview of sustainers. And so commanders and G3s and XOs weren't really thinking in terms of operational art, which is how we come up with our operational approaches. You know, sustainment really needs to be a point of departure in terms of thinking about operational art, certainly for conventional warfare. So in the 20 odd months since we released 3.0, we've gotten virtually no pushback in terms of decisive shaping and sustaining operations going away. And so people are comfortable with the model, main efforts, supporting efforts, and reserve. And I don't think we would have been able to really know what the feedback would be outside of an actual conflict if MCTP wasn't providing units the opportunities to experiment with the new doctrine. I think the other piece that we had is that in terms of thinking about the operational environment, the environment and then the operational framework as you apply to it, is we reemphasize the importance of thinking through areas of interest and areas of influence. Because if you're going to assign a unit an area of operations or an assigned area, and you expect it to be conducting operations, you can't give it an area of operations that's larger than it can actually influence. And there's some real considerations in terms of things like, you know, math stuff like ranges of your fire systems, the ability to generate rotary wing sorties of attack aviation, the ability to execute log packs, and how long can your ASR or MSR be and still be able to make the turns every day to keep your ABCTs fuel. Those kinds of things get into areas of influence. And so when you apply that operational framework in terms of the operations you want to conduct, you got to make sure you size things the right way. So I think those are the big things that I would talk about in terms of the current FM3O.
I have a question, a hypothetical, so I don't know if you can answer it. So the 2017 version, you think about this is the beginning of the shift to large-scale combat operations, and that publication was really meant to drive the Army culture away from GWAT. Do you think if the close, deep support and consolidation areas were maybe in 2022, that consolidation area would have stuck?
Well, I think part of the challenge became there was this intellectual disconnect in terms of people reading the doctrine. So people understood the framework, and they understood that the consolidation area really was the rear area in most of the ways that you could portray it graphically, even though that's not how it was written, right? Mm-hmm. You could be consolidating gains, you know, in some urban area on the flank that's not in the rear area, you know, if you were able to secure it, for example. Well, those all became hypotheticals. And what happened was Chapter 8 of the 2017 book was Consolidate Gains. That's where we covered the subject matter. And it's the last chapter of the book, so when you write a 384-page doctrinal publication, by the time people get to the end of the book, they're not really paying too close of attention. And so what happens was that people would talk about the consolidation phase, and it's the last thing that you're going to do, which was never the intent. Right. It was the doctrine that always said that, hey, you want to consolidate gains as continuously as possible, as quickly as possible. So by giving it its own piece of the operational framework, you were reinforcing this idea that it's the last thing you do because it's associated with the rear area. So therefore, after everybody else has moved forward during the conduct of their operation and sees their objectives, somebody else is in the rear or in the consolidation area, consolidating gains, which was not the intent. We wanted to consolidate gains as quickly as possible. So it would have been an interesting thought experiment, but I think an awful lot of people were just relieved that we did away with it because deep, close, rear was a multi-generational thing that people understood. And even when it wasn't doctrine, I think that was still in the shorthand.
Well, you know, if I could add, I think that when it comes to the principles of war, simplicity is something that we oftentimes overlook and is something that I think is extremely important as we create these frameworks, both doctrinal and then what can be applied operationally. And so sometimes having, you know, four or five or six options of things may not necessarily be simple, whereas having a main effort and supporting effort is relatively simple. And I think that there's a lot of value to using that principle of war as we create and continue to evolve doctrine.
Yeah, amen on the simplicity. And that was absolutely one of the benefits. And it was something that we agreed with completely.
Absolutely. As I listened to you talk through the inner dynamic, the imperatives that are part of our 3O doctrine, And the imperative to see yourself, see the enemy, and understand the operating environment, I think really rings true to the operational framework. You know, whether that's through FFIR, the Friendly Force Information Requirements, or EFI, the essential elements of friendly information, more or less seeing the enemy from PIR or priority information requirements in order to see yourself in that framework, I think is extremely important. And that inner dynamic of a main effort and supporting effort definitely help along the lens of that imperative.
Yeah, and I think you can't make too much of this idea of simplicity. The fewer models you have and the more flexible those models are, I think the better off everybody is. And I think the forward of FM3O that really kind of brings that out is the operational framework that helps echelons better organize their forces in terms of time, space, and purpose. And it's better because it's more simple and more clear. I didn't even mention the other aspects of it. There were a couple other things we brought back that were a little bit different. So only certain types of formations have assigned areas of operation because they have to be able to perform certain tasks. So what does everybody else have? So we cleaned up some things, not just in FM3O, but in FM390 in terms of, you know, you've got two kinds of assigned areas, either a plain old assigned area because you're not a maneuver type formation, or you've got an area of operations in which you're expected to deal with enemy forces. The other thing we did is we brought back this idea of sectors and zones, sectors for the defense, which basically means that you've got an open-ended framework to your front, and then the same thing for zones for the attack. And that's something from, you know, we did away with about 20 years ago, and we brought back. Now, it hasn't manifested itself necessarily much in terms of graphic control measures and so forth during the conduct of operations yet. But that's more due to a lack of emphasis because people are comfortable with doing things a certain way, and there's nothing wrong with that. But again, we just did it to increase flexibility.
So there's three models, and you talked assign areas, deep, close, and rear operations, and then the main effort, supporting effort, and reserve. Anything else that we should make sure listeners have a solid understanding before we dive more into the call and book?
No, I mean, I think that's the fundamentals of it. You got one part of the framework that's really about what you're responsible for. You've got one part of the framework that talks about the operations that you're going to conduct. And then another in terms of how you're prioritizing resources. I think the other big thing for listeners to think through, and I'd be interested in what Ike's got to say on this, but operational framework is designed for echelons above brigade. It's designed for divisions and corps. That's been true since we created the operational framework way back in 1982 in FM100-5 for airland battle. Does that mean that other echelons can't talk about themselves in terms of having a deep fight or a close fight or a rear fight? No, it doesn't. But that's not what it's intended for. And it links to this idea of the division as the primary tactical formation for conventional warfare. And it kind of tracks with our thinking in terms of deep, close, and rear operations. So inform way for brigades to say, hey, my deep fight is this and I'm doing rear operations in the BSA. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just not what we talk about in doctrine. But it certainly works at that level. That's just not what the focus is in terms of what FM3O says.
No, I think that absolutely it is designed for division and higher, but it helps if that framework is there and it helps echelons that are smaller than division work through their transition points as what is their deep and what are they handing off. Or what is their rear and what are they handing off? That certainly is, you know, a great mental model or cognitive framework for people to work through. But without a doubt, I think it does lend itself to a larger geographic area that a division or corps would be responsible for.
When we have people ask us, you know, well, what if I want to use decisive shaping, sustaining? And we said, well, sir, ma'am, you go right ahead. You just need to make sure that your higher echelon is using the same operational framework and that your lower echelons are as well. The highest tactical echelon gets the decisive vote in terms of what operational framework. So we didn't ban it. And we specifically say commanders can use whatever operational framework is most effective in the context of the operations they conduct. But just make sure everybody's on the same sheet of music or you're going to have mass confusion.
Well, let's dive into the call handbook, Colonel Akenna. I'd like to unpack what you're seeing with operational framework at the division and core warfighters. So the handbook states that, quote, units develop an incomplete operational framework during the military decision-making process and do not have a system or means to adjust the operational framework during execution. So I think first, could you unpack the part about the incomplete operational framework? What are you seeing with that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, deliberate planning and deliberate planning is both art and science, and oftentimes it is not as deliberate as we would want it to be. And so I think, you know, making sure that you've got the framework established through the lens that Rich just kind of talked through as far as those three major functions with the areas assigned, what is deep, close, and rear, and then your prioritization is extremely important. In the base plan, and we all know that plans are not necessarily executed well, but you've got to understand with the base plan, a departure that everybody has shared understanding of. And so not creating graphic control measures when you're not in contact does not create shared understanding or common understanding. And so when I say shared and common understanding, for instance, does the entire formation understand what the base plan is? An example of that would be the night shift or the people that are driving you from point A to point B. Yes, that's an important protection and security capability, but when they get into your command node, do they understand what the base control measures are, and then, you know, what the roles and responsibilities and authorities are associated with that. And so you may not have the authority to do a certain function in a given area. And so, you know, the importance of having rehearsals across the staff. Oftentimes, rehearsals are focused upon units, but the staff and the function of staffs at division and higher echelon are extremely important to make sure that the people on the staffs understand, you know, this boundary is extremely important because of why, or, you know, this control measure gives us the authority to do a certain thing, and making sure that everybody understands, not only from a doctrinal perspective, but then within the rules of engagement and the operating environment in which they're conducting the exercise or the operation is extremely important. Because if you don't have that base in planning as you shift into execution, it's going to become much more pressurized much more stressful than in kind of the controlled environment of planning.
When you're talking about the authorities, could you give an example?
An example, cross boundary fire. If you know, the boundary of a division may also be an international border.
Okay.
And so that international border may, based on where you are in time and space of the operation, you may not have the authority to shoot across a given international border. And that would be an example of an authority that does not exist. It's a boundary, and you may have the ability from a blue perspective or from a U.S. perspective to shoot across the boundary with coordination, but that there is no authority because you would have to coordinate with a different nation to shoot across that, as an example.
Okay.
With some of our senior mentors, we had a pretty spirited conversation about 18 months ago, maybe 2 years, where we're all arguing about the forward boundary. So we're conducting offensive operations and we're assigning forward boundaries as a way to differentiate which echelon is responsible for which group of enemy forces, right? I'm still convinced that I was correct in this conversation, but folks are confused. We're confusing, and we got into a habit based on operations in Afghanistan or Iraq where you always had a forward boundary if you were coming off your FOB, because you either were bounded by another brigade combat team's AO, another division's AO, or an international boundary. There was never an exception to that. There was always somewhere, if you drove in a straight line, you were going to run into somebody else's unit boundary. Back before we went to Afghanistan, Iraq, I argue that we never had forward boundaries during offensive operations. And we did things like limits of advance, and we just assigned different targeting responsibilities for different enemy capabilities. And it was this continuous dialogue about, you know, what the core artillery is shooting at versus what the division artillery would be shooting at, or what joint fires were taking place. Anyways, it got pretty heated. And I know our TTP now is to in place or move unit forward boundaries. And that's another topic for future discussion. But I think it really all it gets back to is being on the same sheet of music. And I think the other thing that's true, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, like, but one of the problems that you always had in the old days when you had everything on acetate was that your assistant G3 or your deputy G3 or your assistant brigade S3 or whoever, the commander's like, well, we gotta shift the boundaries. We got to shift these things. And that was physical labor, right? And it was a pain in the neck. You needed to pull it down. You had to use the alcohol to rub it off. You had to carefully put a line back up and stick it onto the map. And CPOF is not much easier, though it wasn't back in the day, to shift boundaries around as you're looking at a little screen that's, you know, 8x12. But you got to draw this thing in and move it from screen to screen to make it happen. And so I always suspected, it was certainly true in 2ID when I was there, that our reluctance to shift boundaries quickly was reluctance to deal with that. It wasn't anything. It wasn't like we were forgetting. It was that, do we really have to do that yet? Do we really have to do that? I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I don't want to get you in trouble with it.
No. I think the tempo of large scale combat operations is a challenge, and the framework which we create is important, but at the same time, having the agility to change that framework as the enemy gets a vote. And, what if we get it wrong? And what if we templated something at a given point and that's not where they're at? We're going to need to shift what the framework is in order to ultimately get after that objective. And so with the technology that we have, we don't like to plan for not being successful, but sometimes the template, the doc temp, the doctrinal temp is not the way that it's employed, either based on geography or based on the enemy deciding something different, and or the environment contributes to the enemy not doing what we thought that they would do doctrinally. And so there are a lot of different factors that are out there that certainly contribute to having to change it and shift it. But then it's the inner dynamic of who has the authority to change it.
Sure.
And then how do you create that shared understanding across the echelons? Mm-hmm. And so, sure, when you're, you know, doing acetate, you were, you know, only able to do it as quickly as your driver could copy the acetate and get it down to the next echelon. Whereas, you know, as you create a layer on CPCE, that layer can instantly be grabbed by multiple echelons. But then when is it effective in making sure that everybody understands who can change it, and then making sure that it's a perishable date time group, so that when it does change, that everybody understands that you've changed the version 6 or version 7 or this version that has a date time group, because it can get very, very convoluted very quickly if you don't manage, have the knowledge management technique to be able to leverage all that.
Yeah. So dare say we need to be agile in our application of the operational framework, right? You know, one of the TTPs they used to do, and you could absolutely probably go back in time, say 30 years. One of the ways you would get around not having the modern technology and systems to be able to share digital graphics was you put a lot of phase lines out there. I mean, every piece of terrain that was identifiable, you would lay a phase line, and it was because you didn't know when you were going to be able to use it. So the more graphics you did during the deliberate planning, the more able you were to shift the operational framework in terms of deep, close, and rear, because you could on order with a time via voice phase line. You know, Kansas is now the CFL phase line. whatever, Arkansas is now the FSCL. Your forward line of troops is now at this phase line. Your limit of advance now is at this phase line. And you could do all those things, but you had to really put in the work ahead of time. And that gets to deliberate planning.
Without a doubt. I mean, you know, why is it an objective and an objective? Well, it's just not a circle on a map. There should be some analysis to that circle that talks about the boundaries or the city limits or a given terrain feature, making sure that you know, you have the ergonomics of that correctly. And it's just not some arbitrary thing on a map.
One thing that the call handbook talked about was confusing like boundaries with fire support coordination measures, specifically the FSCL and the CFL. As a fire scouter, could you kind of talk about that, where the confusion lies?
No, and Rich kind of hit on this a little bit as far as creating multiple phase lines, which really are boundaries, in order to make sure that you've got a good framework and so that you're just not shifting from a coordinated fire line to a coordinated fire line. A coordinated fire line really is, it's a control measure, a friendly control measure, so that you do not necessarily need to coordinate surface-to-surface fires on the land beyond that CFL. But it is really there for permissive fires, not necessarily to control who is responsible for the geography. That certainly is part of that equation. And so making sure that you do have boundaries left and right or front and rear or in a non-contiguous battlefield, that becomes even more challenging. But making sure that you've got those boundaries in place so that you can draw CFLs, fire support coordination lines, FSCLs, are controlled by the land component commander. They're not even controlled by a division or a corps. And so the thing, you know, is the CFL is what a division and or corps can control. And but something like a FSCL is something that you've got to go to the theater commander or the land component commander in order to change, because that starts getting into joint effects. And that takes time to coordinate, to make sure the joint force is tracking that change to the fire support coordination measure as it goes to the Air Force, the Navy, and all the other capabilities within the joint force that need to coordinate based on that control measure.
Could you talk the link between the operational framework, the ATO, or the air tasking order, and joint enablers?
Sure. I mean, the framework, the operational framework, gives us that common lexicon as far as the deep, close, and rear area from the land component perspective, which then expands to the joint force, which ultimately the core is going to be the integrator or joint enablers, where we can leverage the different capabilities that the joint force has. And so it is important to be able to delineate the roles, responsibilities of those areas in order to bring to bear, to mass joint effects at the appropriate time and space with the joint enablers that the core is able to leverage. The ATO cycle that you talked about is also obviously a framework. It is a very fixed framework that does not have a lot of flexibility. And so making sure that we can see ourselves in time and space using the ATO cycle is a good way to for us to cognitively develop that operational framework.
So it sounds like we're advocating for an operational framework because it's not just yourself, and you are part of a bigger process within the joint force.
Without a doubt. So, a division has their operational framework, and the division deep is there based on the capability of the weapon systems that the division owns. So, for instance, rocket artillery. Rocket artillery has a given range. And so that deep fight is delineating what the division capability, rocket capability, can reach out and destroy. And so if You do have to make adjustments to it because as the tempo or offensive operation changes, sometimes that deep area will either shrink or contract based on where you are, either in offensive or defensive operations. And so, but everybody, you know, once you draw that area out in the operational framework, everyone down to that rocket platoon leader is going to understand where they are in time and space geographically, with the appropriate doctrinal authorities of what their roles and responsibilities are. Then likewise, obviously, you shoot rockets through the air. So the air component is very, very interested in where those battery positions are, those platoon or battery positions for the rockets are, in order to make sure that they are not flying, you know, in a dangerous area in order to employ those capabilities. And so it is definitely important to communicate it in as doctrinally sound as possible. Because if you start deviating from doctrine, as I think Rich talked about earlier, making sure that everybody understands what you're talking about becomes challenging, and it becomes even more challenging as you go external to the Army, because the joint force is going to be looking for what a joint doctrine is for what you're doing. And if you start creating things, it becomes more and more challenging because you don't have that shared lexicon, that shared understanding that ultimately is one of those principles that unlocks mission commands, is having shared understanding of the environment.
That shared understanding thing is a really big deal. And I think you run into this, but we certainly hear about it if we don't get to observe it nearly as many times a year as you do. But problem with understanding is people don't understand what the graphical control measures or a fire support coordination measure mean. Like, I don't need you to give me the definition, but what does it do for you? And when you look at the totality of joint doctrine in terms of air ground integration, you look at the totality of Army doctrine for airspace management and control and the employment of fires, you actually have every tool you would need. But I think sometimes when people don't understand what all of those terms are and how they can be brought to bear, they're looking for a methodology. They're almost looking for like the game plan. Instead of looking at it as this is the playbook, I've got a whole lot of plays that I can use, and I've got an infinite number of combinations that I could bring to bear to solve this military problem, as long as I understand what all those things are. And you've seen it where, you know, people think, well, the Air Force can't do anything short of the fire support coordination line, right? Well, that's not true. Or I've got this, you know, they don't know what a kill box is. Or there's this misunderstanding that I can't fire across a restricted fire line when actually I can. I just need to have a plan for doing that. And I probably should always have a plan for doing that because the enemy is not operating according to our graphical control measures or even our operational framework. And then all you have to do is think, you know, it could be part of close operations for CAS sorties in the air tasking order to be taking place in the close area in support of close operations. Because it's close air support, that doesn't necessarily mean it's in the deep operation. It may be something that's coming right over your shoulder. I'm not saying it would, but in an era where unmanned systems are proliferating, and the Air Force may control some of those, or some other Army echelon may be controlling some of those and using them for strikes, I think we need to not think in terms of a methodical battle approach. We want to know what our methods are, but be able to think about them in a very flexible way.
Without a doubt, Rich, in a recent warfighter, I heard a command sergeant major say, "Why we're trying to understand this? Why? For what are we trying to understand?" In because the for what is extremely important, and so the common and shared understanding is part of it. But then that control measure is there in order to streamline, for lack of better terms, fires, or to restrict it in order to protect maybe something in another domain that we're not necessarily aware of in the domain that we're operating in. And so I think the for what to understanding is extremely important when it comes to understanding.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, what else did I miss about the operational framework?
Yeah, so for the operational framework, I just want to kind of very briefly go over three observations of typically what occurs if it does not necessarily get set. We've talked about some of the challenges to set the operational framework, but oftentimes, if it is not set, the tempo for our forces is oftentimes unsynchronized. And so because the enemy gets a vote and we don't necessarily move through an operating environment exactly as we have planned, a combination of those two things oftentimes do create things that are unsynchronized. And so the plan should initially have synchronization in it, but then the execution of that plan is challenged as we go through. And so the other part is just simple confusion. If you are expecting something to be destroyed in the deep area and it is not destroyed, and then you continue on with plan, there's confusion. And then oftentimes that confusion leads to risk. If you expected that battalion of fires, enemy fires, to be destroyed or neutralized, and we didn't touch it, but yet we continue along the plan as if, oh, of course it did. We didn't have a good assessment or a good sensing capability to see that it wasn't destroyed. Then the risk to force from a friendly unit perspective certainly increases a great deal. So those are some things that are results of the operational framework either not being set or not being agile enough.
I love that cognitive piece, sir. I feel like we could do a whole episode on how our brains think, you know, via MCTP experience.
Yeah, what you expect to see. So it must be happening because I expect that to happen. And we did everything we were supposed to do. So therefore, everything must be okay. All right. But people like to, we would never do this, like, but, you know, people say, well, that was just simulation. Well, in actuality, what do you think the real world is easier than simulation? I don't think so. I think the real world would be every bit as challenging and for all the same reasons.
Without a doubt. I mean, the tools and processes that we use, the way that commanders dialogue with one another in terms of risk, the tactical scenario may be a little bit different in a warfighter exercise, but those are all reps and sets that commanders and their staffs get. I mean, for instance, anytime a staff can listen to their commander visualize and describe an operating environment, they're doing that mainly from an artful perspective, but then that staff has to be able to turn that art into the science of whatever capability of the warfighting function is that they operate in. And so the more reps and sets that staffs get in listening to their commanders, see the operating environment through the lens of an operational framework, then they can start filling in the science of each of their warfighting functions to ultimately have that balance of art and science that is ultimately what we do as a profession.
Well, and right, you may start the point of departure for coming up with your operational framework is always going to be art because it's visualization at first, informed by a little science. But I mean, how often does your original operational framework hold up by the time you get done with your planning? Because the science is going to drive reality, right? And your constraints are almost entirely based on math of some kind. And so that's okay, but that's where that conversation between the staff and the commander is so important. Like, hey, boss, I know you wanted to do this, but we can't get there yet. So we need to use joint capabilities, you know, to do that. And by phase two of this operation, we will have extended the operational framework to get after the problem that you want us to solve.
Sir, I know there's a lot of other stuff in the call handbook. Do you want to hit on any of the other key observations?
Yeah, I will. So we have a top five observation. Obviously, the top one is the operational framework that we just talked through. But just very briefly, the other four within the top five is, you know, managing integration and synchronization at Echelon. And so how you integrate and synchronize at Echelon is a challenge, and we kind of talk through the observations there. We talk about operations in the rear area, which a lot of people have biases towards that may or may not apply. And so we have some observations for there, as well as how we have multinodal distributed command posts. Obviously, with what's going on operationally in Europe right now, that is a hot topic, and there's been a lot written about it. We provide some observations from warfighter exercises. And then lastly, how a headquarters collectively trains something that we see quite frequently as far as what they need to do to get after their collective training. But I tell you, the call website has a ton of stuff. Obviously, this handbook is only one of many things. We also, the MCTP team, put together an article about the rhythm of the battle, vice the battle rhythm, that also was published in the earlier part of this year. That's actually on the call website. That's article 852 within the call website, the rhythm of the battle, a very good read that the team has put together to get after not being fixed to a battle rhythm, because the rhythm of the battle oftentimes directs things, vice the arbitrary time that you're doing a bore, bureau, working group, or cell may not apply to when the enemy decides to attack or mass. And so you have to have that, the agility in order to operate within the rhythm of the battle.
Sounds great, gentlemen. Any parting thoughts?
No, I just really appreciate Ike joining us here. We've been wanting to do this for a while. So great conversation, and it's always good hearing all the stuff that you guys have learned in any given training year. So this is fun.
Absolutely. It's great to be able to talk doctrine. Obviously, our OCTs are doctrinally sound, and having that point of departure is extremely important in order for us to give feedback to the training units through MCTP. As we strive to enable professional warfighting each and every exercise that we create and execute.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the Kurin Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Mr. Zarek Fry from 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on Amazon Music, Apple, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, or YouTube. Also, go ahead and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.